have your Bible, I know that you do. Go ahead and join me in Daniel chapter 2. And tonight we're going to work our way quickly through all 45 verses of this second chapter. Daniel, as we have seen, is a book about the sovereignty of God, both in the big things and the little things. It's also a book that contains very important prophecies, and also a book that contains a number of important apocalyptic prophetic visions as well. When you come to chapter 2, you come to a new section or a unique section really in all the Bible, because the Old Testament is written almost exclusively in Hebrew, except for Daniel chapter 2, verse 4, through Daniel chapter 7 and verse 28. And so what I put up on the board is a diagram that actually shows you that these five chapters, or six chapters actually, are chiastically designed. And you say, what does that mean? Well, the outside chapters 2 and 7 correspond, and the inside chapters correspond as well. So tonight we're going to see a vision of a giant statue. Later when we get to chapter 7, we'll see that same vision, but they are depicted in four ravenous beasts. You then see that you have the story of the fiery furnace in chapter 3, and you have the story of Daniel in the lion's den in chapter 6. And then chapters 4 and 5, and any time you see a chiastic structure, what's in the center is most important. And even though it doesn't have the really cool vision or the really cool story, it talks about the fact that God judges pride, which of course is at the very heart of sin. And therefore you see God judging Nebuchadnezzar, turning him into a wild beast-like person in chapter 4. And you see God dealing with Belshazzar in chapter 5 when the Babylonian kingdom falls to the Persians. So there's a very clear diagram or structural sense in which chapters 2 and 7 hang together. So that will help us see that there's some commonality in these particular chapters. And then as I mentioned, chapter 2 verse 4 through chapter 7 and verse 28 is written in Aramaic, which is related to Hebrew, but it is different. Although, in the first century, Jesus almost certainly spoke Aramaic most of the time. Greek was the common language of the Roman Empire. Hebrew was the religious language, but Aramaic was the language that was commonly spoke throughout Palestine, and so it carries over from several hundred years prior to that. So, we're going to walk very quickly because we've got 45 verses to cover. So, I want you to see, first of all, in the first 16 verses, that God often creates impossible situations to reveal His greatness. And He begins by raising up an unbeliever who gives threats and extends his anger, or indeed responds with threats and angers to the situation that God has raised. So look at it there in chapter 2, verse 1. In the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar. Now, Nebuchadnezzar began to reign in 605. This is when he had his first incursion into the land of Judah, and in particular Jerusalem. And so he begins to reign in 605. So this is either the end of 604, sometime in the year 603 B.C. And Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. Now, if you're a Bible marker like me, the word dreams occurs no less than 11 times in this second chapter. Almost all of them, in fact, all of them indeed do occur in the first 9 verses. So he began to have dreams, and his spirit was troubled, and he was not able to sleep. Sleep left him. So you have a king, most powerful man in the world. He's having a difficulty with his sleep. He's having a dream or dreams. It's in the plural. So they were occurring again and again over several days, maybe several weeks, several months for all we know. They troubled him and he was unable to sleep. Well, in the ancient world, especially monarchs would often attach significance to their dreams. They were sometimes omens of coming action, coming events. And if they interpreted their dreams correctly, then they could perhaps take action to prepare themselves for what the dreams seemed to be indicating was going to occur. And this was very common among ancient Near Eastern people. So the king commanded verse 2, and here are his counsel. Here is his college of cardinals, if you like, or his board of directors, or whatever you want to call them, his cabinet. So the king commanded that the number one, the magicians, Number two, the enchanters. Number three, the sorcerers. And number four, the Chaldeans be summoned to tell the king his dreams. Well, verse 3, the king said to them, I had a dream, and my spirit is troubled. I really want to know the content of the dream. And so the Chaldeans said to the king in Aramaic, and there's where you have the shift from Hebrew to Aramaic, O king, live forever, which, by the way, was simply a title of courtesy that they would extend almost any time they would enter into the king's presence. So it's simply like when you see in a court of law, you will address the judge as your honor. Doesn't mean you really think he's honorable. In fact, you may think he's a scallywag, but that's not the way to get your opinion heard or your case heard well. Same thing with the king. You don't go and say, well, king, I think you're a scallywag. As we're going to see in this book, that could immediately result in your head leaving your shoulders or your person being thrown into a fiery furnace or into a lion's den. So, O king, may you live forever. Tell your servant the dream, and we will show you the interpretation. Now, you ought to also mark the word interpretation because it occurs 13 times in this particular text. Well, the king answered and said to the Chaldeans, which probably here is being used as a summary term for the magicians, the enchanters, the sorcerers, all of these people that were diviners and were his counsel. The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, the word from me is firm. Here's what I want, and there is no equivocation. If you do not make known to me the dream, as well as its interpretation, you shall be torn limb from limb, and your houses shall be laid in ruins, with the implication being your houses will be flattened, and where you once lived will be turned into a dunghill, which was very often what would happen when the king took such action against those that he was not pleased with. So he's not just asking them for the interpretation. He's wanting them to also tell him the dream. Now, some people believe that he wants to know the dream because he has forgotten it. And that's possible. Others are arguing or would argue that he wants them to tell him the dream to demonstrate that they're not mere charlatans, that they're not merely taking advantage of his generosity, but they actually are good at what they do in terms of dream interpretation. So he wants them to tell him the dream and the interpretation with the warning. You'll be torn from limb to limb and your house is laid in ruins. On the other hand, verse 6, if you show the dream and its interpretations, so there you see the word dream, like his previous occurrence, is in the singular, which may indicate that he was having the same dream over and over and over and over, which of course then would probably at least cause him to think there is some future significance to this dream that the gods keep giving me again and again and again, which causes me to think, and I would never spill blood over this, that he is not asking, that he knows the dream. He just wants to see if they can likewise identify the dream that he knows. Now, he's not sure of the interpretation, but I think he knew the dream personally. So, if you'll do this, verse 6, you'll receive gifts from me and rewards and great honor. Therefore, show me the dream and its interpretation. Well, verse 7 gives you the impression that they just utterly ignore what he just said. In other words, it's just like, yes, you've said this, and we're just going to ignore that you said that and tell you what we can do. They answered a second time and said, let the king tell his servants the dream, and we will show its interpretation. Well, they tried to bluff the king, and it didn't work, because in verse 8, he fires back and said, I know with certainty that you're trying to gain time, because you see that the word from me is firm. In other words, I'm not budging off my request, both for you to tell me the dream and its interpretation. You're stalling. You're indicating to me that really you're not capable of doing what you claim that you're capable of doing. So, verse 9, if you not make the dream known to me, there's but one sentence for you, which we already know, having been delineated up in verse 5. In fact, you have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me till the times change. That is, until I change my opinion, which he's not going to do. Therefore, tell me the dream and I shall know that you can show me its interpretation. In other words, step up to the plate, deliver the goods, or it's not going to be a happy ending for you. So the Chaldeans now are beginning to feel panicky, which with good reason. I certainly would be. And he said, they said to him, there is not a man on earth who can meet the king's demand, for no great and powerful king has asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or Chaldean. It's interesting. Verse 10 is kind of a mixed bag. On the one hand, they're trying to butter him up. On the other hand, they're saying, what you're trying to get us to do is utterly unreasonable. What does he say? You're a great king. You're a powerful king. But hey, great and powerful king, nobody has ever asked anybody to do something, if I might add a parenthetical phrase, so stupid, ridiculous, unheard of, and impossible. That's in essence what they are saying. So verse 11, the thing that the king asks is difficult, you think? And no one can show it to the king, and this is where they get it right almost, except the gods whose dwelling is not with flesh. In other words, what you are asking us to do is beyond any human capacity. In fact, only a God or one of the gods who is in the spiritual realm, who gave you the dream to begin with, could also reveal the dream and the interpretation. And I would again add on that particular account, they are correct. Only someone in connection with God could provide both the dream and the interpretation. Well, verse 12, because of this, the king was angry and very furious. He really went into an uncontrollable rage. And he commanded that all the wise men of Babylon be destroyed. My entire council, out. My court of advisors, out. We're cleaning house and we're starting all over. And so the decree went out and the wise men were about to be killed, and they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them, which probably means that when the king asked for his council to come, for whatever reason, Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were not there. But guilt by association. Just because they weren't there doesn't mean that they don't get lumped in with the Chaldeans and the magicians and the enchanters and the sorcerers. So they leave from these particular magicians and so on, and they go and look for Daniel and his companions to kill them. God indeed creates impossible situations to reveal His greatness. Unbelievers may respond with threats and anger, but secondly, believers should respond with wisdom and faith. Verse 14. Then Daniel replied with prudence, and also he replied with discretion. We could say he replies wisely and also respectfully. And he did so to Arioch, who is described as the captain of the king's guard, who had gone out to kill the wise men of Babylon. He declared to Arioch, the king's captain, why is the decree of the king so urgent? In other words, number one, I think he's implying, why is it so severe? And secondly, why is he asking for this to be done immediately? Evidently, Nebuchadnezzar not only called for the death sentence, he called for it to be enacted immediately. So Daniel receives the word. He says, well, wait, hold on, time out. Just slow down just a little bit. Why is the decree so urgent? Then Arioch made the whole matter known to him. So he in essence informs him of what we just read in verses 1 all the way down through verse 13. So Arioch made the matter known to Daniel, verse 16. And Daniel went in and requested the king. This shows great courage on the part of Daniel. He goes in and requested the king to appoint him a time, the very thing the king said he wasn't going to give anybody. Now, you don't have any more time. What does Daniel do? Give me some more time. Give me time, and I will show the interpretation to the king. Now, I have to raise a question that will come over when we look in the next section. I don't know if Daniel did this directly or indirectly. In other words, it says that Daniel went in and requested the king to appoint him a time, but that doesn't mean that he actually marched right into the throne room of the king and looking him eyeball to eyeball and made his request. In fact, I would say that's unlikely. Most likely he came in and said, I'd like to send a message to the king, and someone took it to him, because you'll see in a moment that Arioch's going to claim credit for finding Daniel. And he's going to take him into the very presence of the king and say, look what I found. I found somebody that can interpret the dream for you. So I think most likely, though Daniel did go into the presence or the area of the king, he didn't get a face-to-face meeting at this particular point. He just simply sent word that said, there is a guy who says he can interpret the dream. He just asked for a little bit of time. And based I can tell, he just asked for a day. He says, give me a day, I'll come back tomorrow, and I will tell you both the dream and the interpretation. So Daniel does act with great courage. He uses prudence and discernment. He acts wisely and respectfully. Now remember, Daniel's probably still just a teenager. He's just a 15 or 16-year-old boy. And yet he is confident that his God will deliver and that his God will come through for him. Moves to second point then. God delights in the prayers and the praise of His children. And I do agree with those Bible teachers who say really the most important part of Daniel 2 is not the great vision at the end, but Daniel's confession in verses 20 through 23. But notice first of all that he goes to God immediately in prayer. Verse 17. Then Daniel went to the house and made the matter known. To who? Well, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, or Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They're Babylonian names, but here they are referred to in their Hebrew names. So he goes and makes the matter known to his three friends, his companions, and he told them what? May we seek mercy, may we seek grace and kindness and loving kindness from the God of heaven. I would mark that. It's a very important phrase. You say, why? Well, you see it there in verse 18. You'll see it again in verse 19. You'll see it again in verse 28. And you'll even see it on the lips of Nebuchadnezzar later toward the end of the chapter. So, we seek mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his companions might not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. By the way, just a side note, you have every indication in this chapter that even though they were pagans, Daniel also cared about the magicians, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans. He cared about lost people. He was concerned about their situation as much as he was concerned about his own. And so, he is concerned about his three friends. He's concerned about the others of Babylon. Verse 19, then the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision of the night. And so, evidently, he lay down. He went to sleep. You should think about that. If you don't come up with a dream and interpretation the next day, you're going to lose your head. Daniel comes in, shares the issue with the brothers, and said, well, I guess the best thing we can do now is go to sleep. Now, you can only do that when you're confident in who the Lord is. You can't do it any other way. So he goes to bed and he gets the vision. And then we have this beautiful confession of Daniel, which is filled, by the way, with theological truth. Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, to whom belong wisdom and might. I'll tell you what my God does. He changes the times and the seasons. And here's one of the most important verses in Daniel and in the whole Bible. He removes kings and he sets up kings. Who put Barack Obama in the White House? God did. Who's going to put the next president in the White House? God will. Now, whether I like it or not, that doesn't matter. I don't think that Nebuchadnezzar was on Daniel's favorite hit list. But God made him the sovereign of the whole known world. He's going to follow him up with a guy named Cyrus, who's not much better. And then eventually he's going to send a guy along named Alexander the Great. And then later he's going to send on a really wicked guy named Antiochus Epiphanes, who's going to sacrifice a pig on the altar in the temple in Jerusalem. And he wouldn't have done that had God not raised him up. And then God also took him right back out a couple of years later. So God raises up and God takes out. So he changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise, knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and hidden things, like dreams and interpretation of dreams. He knows what is in the darkness, and yet the light dwells with him. To you, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise. Why? For you have given me wisdom and might, and have now made known to me what we asked of you, for you have made known to us the king's matter. Very quickly, if you were to analyze this, basically this hymn or this prayer of praise, seven things can be made in terms of observation. I just note them quickly. Number one, he begins by praising God for his eternality, that he's always been, verse 20. He secondly praises God for His omniscience. He knows everything. And His omnipotence. He can do anything. Verse 20. Number three, he praises God for His sovereignty over the nations. Verse 21, He's the one that raises up and takes out. Number four, he praises God for His gifts of wisdom, His gift of knowledge, His gift of understanding. Fifthly, he praises God for His revelation and knowledge, which is His omniscience again. Verse 22. Sixthly, he praises God for His faithfulness to His people. Verse 23. And seven, he praises God for answering His prayer. Verse 23 as well. And so Daniel goes to God in prayer, and Daniel receives a wonderful answer to his prayer, God's goodness, and therefore he responds in these verses 20 through 23 in wonderful and overt praise. And so verse 24, then Daniel went into Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and said thus to him, "Do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Bring me in before the king, and I will show the king the interpretation." So, God creates the impossible situation. God delights in the prayers and praise of His children. Number three, God reveals the mystery of His kingdom to demonstrate His power. I think verse 24 is one of those hinge verses that concludes verses 17 through 23 or 24 and then picks up with verse 24 and carries it forward. So, one more time, verse 24. Therefore, Daniel went into Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. So he now confronts his executioner. He went and said to him, "Don't destroy the wise men of Babylon. Bring me in before the king," which I think indicates again in verse 16, he did not go into the actual presence of the king. "So bring me in before the king, and I will show the king the interpretation." So Arioch brought in, verse 25, Daniel before the king in haste, and he said to him, I have found. No, you didn't. You just ran across a guy you're going to execute and found out that he could deliver the goods. And so you come in like, "Oh, king, aren't you fortunate to have me? I found somebody. All these other scallywags of yours couldn't do diddly squat, but I found someone among the exiles from Judah. In fact, he is a man who will make known to the king the interpretation." Now, some liberal scholars try to find a contradiction between chapter 2 and chapter 1, because in chapter 1, these guys are brought before the king, and they're known for their, they look good, they act wisely, he gives them positions of authority. But folks, keep in mind, take even again the President of the United States. How many people do you think are running around the White House and have various and sundry positions? Do you think any president, I don't care which one you pick, has ever known the names of all the people that are running around that area? I seriously doubt it. In fact, it's possible that they brought Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in before the king. He said, "Yep, you've done well. They look nice. Give them this position." And he didn't see them again for maybe a year, 2 years. They were probably 13, 14. Maybe now they're 15, 16. They probably look different. Hadn't seen them in a while. So now they come back in, and I think it's like, "Well, who are they?" They tell, "Oh, those boys. Yeah, I kind of remember them." I mean, I can be honest with you. I got so many students running around Southeastern Seminary. People show back up in my office, and I'm like, "Dear Lord, are they here now, or were they here 5 years ago? Were they friendly or unfriendly? Were they troublemakers?" I mean, and I can't remember. Now, you say that's just because you don't have a very good mind. Well, that's a given. But I don't think necessarily Nebuchadnezzar was a rocket science either. Just because he was a great military leader doesn't mean he was brilliant. It just means he was a great military leader in that particular area of his life. I know some guys are really smart in one area, like really stupid and dumb in the other. In fact, this is for free, and I got to keep going. I can't waste. Do you know that most PhDs are not very good with money? In fact, if I told you tonight, if I gave you a test, name me all the PhDs you know that are billionaires, I can tell you one thing, that list is real short. In fact, there may be a zero. Now, they're smart. They got, you know, a lot going on up here. The fact is, the people that are really good at making money, they have a knack or an intuition. It's amazing. I could list forever millionaires who don't even have a college degree. I could start with Bill Gates. I can start with Sam Walden. I can start with J.B. Hunt, who built the largest trucking company in the world. He was seventh grade educated. But man, he could look at someone and say, I can make money off of that. And they just have that knack and that ability. Put them in a classroom where they've got to study chemistry and algebra and Greek, and they're going down. But put me in an area where you got to make money, and I'm going down. And so we all have our different gifts and abilities. So Nebuchadnezzar was clearly a military genius. He may have even been very adept at building. Doesn't mean he necessarily had good memory skills. I mean, he could have been just one of those guys that just doesn't pay attention to things. So anyway, he brings him in, and he says, I found someone who can make known to the king the interpretation. Verse 26. So the king declared to Daniel, whose name, that is his Babylonian name, was Belteshazzar. He brought him in and said, are you able to make known to me the dream that I have seen and its interpretation? And so he raises the question that needs to be raised, and then look at the humility of Daniel. Verse 27. Daniel answered the king and said, No wise man, enchanter, magician, or astrologer, which is sometimes how the word Chaldean is translated. It's kind of used interchangeably. None of these can show the king the mystery that the king has asked. Well, I thought you could. Well, I can't, but there is a God in heaven, the same one he prayed to in verse 18. He reveals mysteries, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be when in the latter days. Now, don't overread that phrase, because the latter days could be virtually any time after the time of Daniel. You say, no, it's got to be the very end of the end of time. No, not necessarily. Not necessarily, although I think it's going to push us in that direction. What we're about to see is going to take place over the next several hundred years. In other words, put it in our context, Daniel shows up to our Bible study night and says, I'm going to tell you what's going to happen. In the year 2100, 2300, 2500, 2700. I'll name for you the empires and the kings that are coming. Now, to me, that'd be pretty impressive. And I would consider that to be a long time out from now, and it could fit into a phrase like the latter days. So he says, verse 28 in the middle, your dream and the visions of your head as you lay in the bed are these. And here he goes. To you, O king, as you lay in your bed, so he even tells him where he had the dreams, came thoughts of what would be after this. That's the same phrase for in the latter days. And he who reveals mysteries, that is my God, made known to you what is to be. As for me, the mystery has been revealed to me, not because of any wisdom that I have, more than all the living, but in order that the interpretation may be known to the king, and that you may know the thoughts of your mind. So Daniel readily acknowledges in verses 24 through 30, only the God of heaven knows all things. Alright? Number two, and here now comes, we move to the heart of the vision. Only the God of heaven can do all things. First of all, letter A, God revealed the content of the dreams in verses 31 through 35. Look at it there. You saw, O king, and behold, a great image. This image, mighty and of exceeding brightness, stood before you, and its appearance was frightening. So he sees an image, which we learn is a giant statue, all right? The head of this image was made of fine gold. Its chest and arms were made of silver. Its middle and thighs were made of bronze. And its legs, very interestingly, of iron. But its feet, partly of iron, a very strong substance, but also partly of clay, a much more fragile substance. And as you looked, a stone was cut out, and here's a key phrase, by no human hand. So who cut that stone? God did. And it struck the image on its feet of iron and clay, and it broke them. You could translate it, it shattered them into pieces. And when that happened, the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold all together were broken in pieces, and they became like chaff of the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away so that not a trace of them could be found. By the way, you want to know what God thinks of man's kingdoms? There it is. It's what God thinks of what we build. It's where God thinks about what we construct. Several years ago, my dear friend Tom Elliff was sharing with me that he's had, when he was living in Oklahoma, He had one house destroyed by fire and another house destroyed by a tornado. And I'm just like, I think I'd found me a different place to live. But anyway, so he lost his house by fire, lost a house by a tornado. But when he lost the house by fire, he was a missionary for many years in Africa. And he is a big hunter. Any hunters in here? Me, used to be. I don't hunt. I'm not going to shoot Bambi. I'm not going to shoot Rocky the squirrel. I don't have these kind of insecurities. Well, he had a house full, I mean full, of trophies from Africa. And when that fire burned his house, it burned it down to nothing but the concrete floor. So they're walking up. Their house is gone. There's nothing. I mean, no clothes, no books, no trophies from Africa. And Tom said, Jeannie, his wife, looked at him and said, well, I guess you know what God thinks about all your trophies now, don't you? Well, that's what God thinks of the empires and the kingdoms that men build. They are someday going to be like the chaff of the summer, and the wind carries them away, and not a trace of them can be found. But the latter part of verse 35, but the stone that struck the image, it became a great mountain, and it filled the whole earth. So now the question. What exactly is the specifics of this statue that Nebuchadnezzar saw? And in your outline, I've given it to you very clearly. Babylon, I'll give it to you, then we'll walk through the verses. Babylon is the head of gold. Medo-Persia is the chest and arms of silver. Greece, under Alexander the Great initially, is the middle and thighs of bronze. And Rome is the leg of iron with feet of iron and clay. And the stone that smashes and becomes a great mountain is Christ and the kingdom of God. And by the way, we'll see this same vision except for the... Well, actually, you'll see Christ coming in chapter 9 as the apocalyptic Son of Man who undoes all these kingdoms. But when we see the beast, the four beasts in chapter 7, it's the same thing. It'll be about Babylon. It'll be about Medo-Persia, it'll be about Greece, and it'll be about Rome. So we got the same thing unfolding. So let me walk through this quickly, and I'll make a comment or two about each of the kingdoms very quickly. First of all, he says in verse 36 then, this was the dream, and now we will tell the kingdom, the king, its interpretation. Verse 37, you, O king, king of kings, by the way, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom. You didn't get this because you're some great man. You're in this position because God sovereignly put you here. You need to never forget that. Well, he does forget it. In chapter 4, God makes it real clear then what he thinks of people that think they build their own kingdom. So, the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, the might, and the glory. He's given all that to you. And by the way, some people think that he's reflecting here even language that you would find about creation and Adam's actual responsibilities over God's good creation before the fall. So he's picking up on some language like that. So, verse 38. And into whose hand he has given whatever they dwell, wherever they dwell, the children of man, the beasts of the field, the birds of the heavens, making you the ruler over them all. You are the head of gold. And by the way, Nebuchadnezzar is considered by many to be the greatest king of the ancient world. Amazingly, the Babylonian Empire would only last 65 years. It would be established in 605 B.C., and it would come to an end in 539 B.C., just 65 years. One of the shortest worldwide empires. In fact, it is the shortest of the great empires of the ancient world. Very interesting to see that. All right, so verse 39. This is Medo-Persia, another kingdom inferior to you. It will not be as magnificent as yours, shall arise after you. And he doesn't really give any real commentary here, though he'll give a lot more commentary about it when we get to chapter 7. But he is talking about Medo-Persia. And Medo-Persia would last from 539 B.C. to 331 B.C., so it would last more than 200 years. So, though it is not as magnificent as the Babylonian Empire was, its duration will be much, much longer. All right? The third kingdom, he says, yet a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over the earth, will come after the second kingdom. Well, we'll later learn from the Bible text itself that this particular kingdom is Greece. And of course, Greece was initially established by perhaps the greatest general of all time, that being Alexander the Great, who by the age of 30 had conquered the entire known world at that particular moment. And then 3 years later, we're almost certain that he was poisoned, and he died, and upon his death, his kingdom will split into four different kingdoms that will then dominate what we call the intertestamental period. That is, the Old Testament ceases its writing about 400 B.C. Well, basically, the Greek Empire commences about 356 B.C., and it will last all the way down to 146 B.C., so a little bit more than 180, close to 190 years, all right? Then he says in verse 40, there shall be a fourth kingdom, strong as iron, because iron breaks to pieces and shatters all things. And like iron that crushes, it shall break and crush all of these. Now, he is clearly here, I believe, talking about the empire of Rome. And Rome, by some people's account, goes all the way from 146 B.C. In fact, in my notes, I've got it written down. Let me find it. Some people say this. Everyone agrees. Rome begins its rule about 146 B.C. Some say it reigned until 395 A.D. Some say 476 A.D. Some say 1054 A.D. Some say 1453 A.D. And some would even say, in one sense or another, the Empire of Rome reigned all the way to 1476 A.D. I would argue that even vestiges of Rome is still with us today, because it so shaped and dominated the Western culture, which we, of course, are heirs of. And so it will last longer. It will be more powerful. In fact, there's no debate. There has been no worldwide dominating empire like Rome ever. So we look at America. We've only been around a couple hundred years. We've just been around a couple hundred years. I mean, we're just piddly in comparison to all. Better than Babylon, not as good as hardly any of the rest of them. Furthermore, how long have we been a world empire? I guess you could sort it, if you want to, date it about the 1920s, the First World War, or even then. Now, everybody would say we were the most dominant empire. They would just say we joined in with the others. Britain was still viewed as the Mac Daddy at that particular point in time in history. So really, we kind of come on the scene as the really, mega empire at the end and during World War II. Okay, that's 1945. That ain't a long time. Now, it's a long time to us. That's because we're such an infant country, that's just, we can't even begin to appreciate. When you go overseas, if you ever do, and you engage in people in England or France or Germany, they just have a different way of looking at the world. They've been around a long time. We've been around a very, very short time. In fact, they look at us as their little adolescent brother. But the problem is, we're a big, kind of bully adolescent brother, and when we get ticked off, we just leave a mess everywhere. But then it's good, because we always go back and clean it up, and you're better off after we come back in and fix your mess. Ask Japan and Germany. In fact, I read a book a few years ago about the future by a guy that actually had a PhD and made some pretty interesting prognostications that didn't seem all that utterly ridiculous. And he said, if you study history and you anticipate history, it's really not a bad idea if you are a country that's struggling in certain ways to pick a fight with America, because the odds are pretty good that we won't annihilate you. We're not into that. So we will bring you to the verge of it. I mean, think about what we could have done with the atomic weapons that we had, both to Japan and Germany. I mean, we could have wiped both countries off the face of the earth. We could have. In fact, we could have wiped everybody off the face of the earth at that particular moment in time. But we didn't. So what did we do with Germany? We rebuilt it. What did we do with Japan? We rebuilt it. And both of them today are world economic powers because of what we did after our defeating of them. So just an interesting thing to think about. But Rome comes along, and Rome is like this giant blob. And as it spreads out, it just takes in everything that it encounters, which is why this particular text says in verse 41, "And as you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, it shall be a divided kingdom." It eventually is going to begin to splinter out. "But some of the firmness of the iron shall still be in it, just as you saw iron mixed with the soft clay. So when it says it's a divided kingdom, most scholars agree that we're talking about something that is bringing in various kingdoms that have no choice but to yield to Rome. And yet in some sense they still maintain their individual identity and even their own culture and so on. So you've got this kind of divided, fragmented reality. You got maybe lots of fingers operating inside this giant entity, this giant hand, if you like, all right? And so he says in verse 43, in fact, as you saw that the iron mixed with soft clay, so they will mix with one another in marriage. And they're not talking about marriage like I do marriage with a wedding contract. They're talking about in the sense of coming together as one. They come together as one Roman Empire, but the fact of the matter is they're all mixed. And think about this. Was Judah, the nation of Israel, a part of the Roman Empire at the time of Christ? Yes. It was part of the Roman Empire. Did it act like it was a part of the Roman Empire? Heck no. They were rebellious. They were stubborn. They were waiting for a Messiah to come and remove the yoke of Rome. Yeah, we may be part of Rome, but we ain't Rome. And we don't act like Romans, and we don't think like Romans, and we don't appreciate Romans. But they were still part of the Roman Empire. Well, that was true all over the world. It wasn't just that way with Israel, with Judah. There were other parts as well. So you've got, again, this conglomeration of people groups that are a part of this world-dominating power. All right. So then he says, though, in verse 44, and in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed, nor shall the kingdom be left to another people. It shall break in pieces all the kingdoms and bring them to an end, and it shall stand forever. Question, when did the kingdom of God begin to manifest itself? At the first coming of Christ. If the Son of God is here, the kingdom is among you. And at the cross and the resurrection, the kingdom begins. Now, what does Jesus say? It's beginning like a mustard seed. It's very small, almost unnoticeable, but let the mustard seed be planted, let the seed die and begin to germinate, and eventually a giant tree is going to result. That's exactly what this text is predicting will happen. So, verse 45. Just as you saw that a stone was cut from a mountain by no human hand, and that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, a great God has made known to the king what shall be after this. The dream is certain, and its interpretation is sure. So my last major point there under number 3, the stone that smashes and becomes a great mountain is Christ and the kingdom of his God. So finally, number 5. Christ honors His servants who faithfully serve Him. First of all, God may choose to have people praise them. Look at what happens amazingly, rather interestingly, in verse 46 and verse 47. Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell upon his face. That is an amazing thing for a king. And he began to pay homage. In fact, it could be translated, he worshipped Daniel. Now, I think he is worshipping the God of Daniel, but he shows his respect for that God to and through Daniel. And he commanded that an offering and an incense be offered up to him. And the king answered and said to Daniel, truly your God is the God of gods and the Lord of kings. Not Lord of lords, but Lord of kings. But you can see where that title is picked up later in Revelation chapter 19. We serve the King of kings and the Lord of lords. So your God is the God of gods and the Lord of lords. Now you would almost think, oh my goodness, isn't this great? Nebuchadnezzar has just had a conversion. He has not had a conversion. I think he's under conviction. I think he recognizes that Daniel's God is something he hasn't encountered before. But like many people who come under conviction and then walk away from the truth, over time that conviction wanes. And over time the reverence of that God grows dim. And before you realize it, you no longer think so much of that God anymore. So much so that in chapter 3, you're going to build your own statue. You're going to make the whole doggone thing of gold because you're a king who's never going to lose his kingdom. And then you can't read chapter 3 rightly without reading in the context of chapter 2. So, he pays homage to Daniel. He says there in verse 48, because why? Your God is the God of God, Lord of lords, a revealer of mysteries, for you've been able to reveal the mystery. Verse 48. So he kept his word. The king gave Daniel high honors and many great gifts. And he made him a ruler over the whole province of Babylon. So, not only did he choose to have people praise him, he had people promote him. So he made him a ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief prefect over all the wise men of Babylon. So now he's kind of the chief of staff or the head of the cabinet. But Daniel, and I love this, you say verse 49 is not all that significant. On one level it isn't, but on the other level it just shows you so much about the character of Daniel, who, by the way, outside of the Lord Jesus, there are two people in the Bible of whom a negative word is never uttered. One is Joseph, and the other is Daniel. And you never, now, they were sinners in need of salvation, still very interesting, never a word is voiced negatively of either one, certainly by God. And what does it say there? Daniel made a request to the king. And the king, he did what? He appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, using their Babylonian names, over the affairs of the province of Babylon. But Daniel remained at the king's court, and now the stage is set for the story of the fiery furnace and the golden statue of chapter 3. And you see, again, Nebuchadnezzar is just the head of gold in chapter 2. In chapter 3, the whole thing's made of gold. And it's almost certain that he made that statue, at least in part, to honor himself. And then you get to chapter 4, and God says, well, let me tell you what I do with guys who think they can take my place. I give them claws like a bird and long hair, and they crawl around, they eat grass like a cow. That's what I do with great kings. Because I raise up who I want to raise up, and I take out who I want to take out. Which again, in the day and age in which we live, gives me a lot of comfort. Because nobody anywhere in this world is sitting on a throne unless God has deemed to allow them to do so. But here's the good news. I don't care who's on the thrones today. 50 years from now, they're all going to be gone. But they're all going to be dead and buried and standing before their Maker. That gives me the ability to put my head on the pillow at night and sleep quite well. Father, thank you for your word. This is an incredible chapter, so much in it, but it kind of lays the foundation for what we'll see in 3 and 4 and 7 for sure, even 8 and 9. And so may we meditate on it over the next week or so, think through what we've read, see how you are working through your servants and how you're dealing with the great kings of this earth. And again, Lord, may we be reminded you raise up and you take out. And that's true for kings and that's true for us as well. And so, Lord, may we walk not like Nebuchadnezzar, which is always a temptation, but may we walk like Daniel, Hananiah, Azariah, Mishael, and be men of humility before the great God of heaven. For it's in your name that we pray all these things. Amen and amen. Thank y'all.